poet. It's Phil Taylor. And you're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM. And today we're going to be having a special guest. We're going to be speaking to the American author Clancy Siegel, who has written a new book, Hemingway Lives, Why Reading Ernest Hemingway Matters Today. And I want to remind you, by the way, next week we're going to be on our membership drive. So you can just jump in right now, go to CIUT.FM and mention when you become a member, tell them you want to be endorsed the Taylor Report. And at the halfway point today, we're going to talk to David Jacobs about this matter in Wales we told you about, that in Wales they have taken down the mural. And that's a sad moment. So we're going to be talking about that. Well, I think that's going to be the main stuff. I'll say again, membership drive starts next week. That would be the 21st, and we expect you all to jump in and support the station. We do a lot of wonderful programming, such as the one we're planning today, which is talking to Clancy Siegel about the significance of Ernest Hemingway and why he is still a major influence and probably going to, let's put it this way, he has a great future in front of him, Ernest Hemingway. To begin, let me just say, to introduce our guest, Clancy Siegel is a Penn Lifetime Achievement Award winner. He's the author of Weekend in Dinlock, Going Away, Zone of the Interior, The Secret Defector, and I'm going to read you the whole title here because it's so remarkable. A Woman of Uncertain Character, The Amorous and Radical Adventures of My Mother Jenny, Who Always Wanted to Be a Respectable Jewish Mom, by Her Bastard Son. And now Clancy has written a terrific book called Hemingway Lives, Why Reading Ernest Hemingway Matters Today. And we're joined, I think, by Clancy Siegel. Are you there, Clancy?
Yes, I certainly am.
Hey, it's great to hear you. You set yourself an interesting task here, considering the career of Ernest Hemingway. I was just mentioning, he seems to have a great future. As you point out, there's an industry around him. But you decided maybe it needed a Clancy Siegel chapter. What first moved you to write the book?
Well, what happened was I'm very reluctant to do it. I'm a lifelong Hemingway reader. I love Hemingway. And I had read a column in a British newspaper that trashed Hemingway because it's a very popular sport. Mm-hmm. And psychoanalyzed him, his father problems, Freudian problems, etc. And I got so pissed off that I wrote a short column, which was picked up by Colin Robinson, an English-born publisher in New York, who said, hey, look, why don't you write a short book about Hemingway, especially aimed at younger people of the Occupy generation? And at first I thought, no, I won't do it. And then I was persuaded to do it as a job. And then I fell in love with Hemingway all over again, and it became a labor of love. Mm-hmm. And it was just a terrific experience for me just to reread Hemingway and revise a whole bunch of my previous opinions.
Well, I'm very glad you did it. I'm going to tell readers, by the way, that it is a wonderful book. It is very, very accessible, and you have a great starting point, which is, well, let's just sort of start with an eraser and go back to what we know about him and his influence. First of all, and he came on the scene a little bit, as they say, meteoric. What was he doing in his writing that caused writers and future writers like yourself to really take note?
Well, let me quote Hemingway for a moment and explain why that's difficult. And this is a quote. In truly good writing, no matter how many times you read it, you do not know how it's done. That is because there is a mystery in all great writing, and that mystery does not dissect out. Each time you reread, you see or learn something new. That precisely describes the experience I had in rereading Hemingway. So we have to be a little careful about not nailing him too precisely. This mm-hmm. is a kid who was born in an affluent Chicago suburb, Oak Park. Yeah? All mm-hmm. white, yeah?
Yeah.
No blacks. Mm-hmm. No Jews. The one mm-hmm. Jewish guy there, Kenneth Turing, the writer, always hid the fact that he was Jewish. So you had a conventionally Victorian, racist, comfortable, very comfortable suburb, yeah? Mm-hmm. He was, there were four sisters in the family. His mother was an overpowering presence. She was a suffragette or pre-suffragette. She made more money than the father, who was a doctor. She obviously dominated the house. Hemingway, in later life, always publicly said how much he hated his mother, but the fact of the matter is there were five women in this suburban house, and this young adolescent boy just boiling over with hormones and ambition, but he didn't know where or how. All he knew was the only way he connected with his dad was when his dad took him up to Upper Michigan to hunt and fish. The father and the son bonded in that way. The father was a deeply depressed man. Remember, you've got a suicide culture all through the Hemingway family. So there's
amazing.
A kind of drain of depression there all the time. But the kid loved going out into the natural world. And that's almost the first thing to know about Hemingway. Mm-hmm. And perfectly normal, active kid in the suburbs. He went to a regular school, had a great journalism teacher. And when he was about 16 or 17 years old, his parents assumed he would be going to college, and he said, no, I'm going to be a cub reporter in that den of iniquity, Kansas City. Off he goes to work for the Kansas City Star. That was the best thing that could have happened to him, because the Kansas City Star was edited and reported on by really fine people, and it had a style sheet. And if you read the style sheet today of the Kansas City Star, it's an absolute textbook of how to write well. And 6 months in Kansas City, roaming around the alleys, following ambulances as a police reporter, that really fixed him up as a writer. And then the war came along in Europe. And mm-hmm. what red-blooded American, Theodore Roosevelt-loving kid wouldn't want to go to war?
Well, let me interrupt you right there on the red-blooded part, and because there's a character that you introduced that it never registered in my thoughts that Teddy Roosevelt had such an impact on everybody. And he's that red-blooded guy. He goes out in the woods, he kills everything he sees, and he believes in a strenuous life. Somewhere along the line, Hemingway seemed to pick up that kind of idea.
I think one of the few original things I say in the book, I discovered, it's an easy thing to make the linkage. Young men, first of all, Teddy Roosevelt was the hero of heroes in the late 19th, early 20th century. He led the Rough Riders up San Juan Hill, and just the look of him, he became tabloid fare. He became the subject of pulp magazines, the cowboy hat, the bristling mustache, the big teeth.
Well, his posture. You know, after you introduced that point, and I look at the pictures in the book, and I say, realize Hemingway resembles him some.
Hemingway not only resembled himself, but patterned himself explicitly on our youngest president, the man who became our youngest president. So much so that when Hemingway got into this habit of doing safaris in Africa, he hired Teddy Roosevelt's guide. So there's a direct link there.
Yes. Well, I found that really, you know, quite remarkable that he chose this, and I guess many American youth did. But marching behind the big-chested guy and let's go get him walked right into World War I after he left Kansas City.
You have to remember, we're talking about a masculine world here. Young Hemingway had to fight his way out of a house that was brimful of female energy. So going to Kansas City and going to war was one way of getting out of the house. When he went to war, I think the war was a tremendous shock to him. The first thing he did when he got off the train in Milan was he was assigned as a Red Cross worker to pick up the mangled bodies of a whole bunch of women who'd been blown up in a munitions explosion. So he just had to walk around with legs and arms and guts. And that was his introduction to the war. A huge amount of difference between that and these patriotic posters. And that should have been his introduction to the war. And then when he actually went to the front line, he insisted on being on the front line, even though a bad eye kept him out of the army. So as the Red Cross ambulance driver, went right up to the front line and got blown up. Being blown up was possibly the central experience of his life. He kept returning to it again and again in his writing and in his life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that that jolt, I want to get to that, because that raises the subject of whether or not he has this new, we have a new modern term, post-traumatic stress disorder. If it was a disorder, well, you tie it in with Edmund Wilson's idea of the wound and the bow, the meditation
right.
over that.
Right. I mean, Edmund Wilson had the idea from Philoctetes, the Sophocles play, that your wound, Philoctetes had this wound, and the wound was what made him the greatest archer in the world. And Wilson said, look, if you're wounded, this could also be the creative making of you. And I think that in Hemingway's case, that was probably true. He almost died under the mortar shell. And remember, he was very, very brave. He was blown to pieces. The people on both sides of him, the Italian soldiers, were blown to pieces. He had machine gun bullets in him. He had mortar fragments in him. He picked up a wounded Italian soldier and dragged him under fire back to the aid station. And this is a guy of a great deal of physical courage. I don't want to move ahead too much, but the fact of the matter is that whatever his faults were, if you were ever in trouble, I mean, if you're in battle or wherever, you really wanted Hemingway at your back. Mm-hmm. I remember an incident when he was living in Cuba and his secretary fell overboard in shark-infested waters. Hemingway, you know, it's like a movie, put a knife between his teeth, dove into the water, dragged her out of the water. This was a physically courageous guy who put a lot of store in being brave and being stoical and being able to take pain.
And being very resourceful. You tell the story that he saved his wife Mary's life when doctors weren't sure what to do, and he said, let's do this and solve the problem.
He had been in battle so often, had seen it so often, he knew exactly what to do when the doctor hesitated about giving her a transfusion. She was dying of an pregnancy, mm-hmm. and he just moved right in and did it because he'd seen it done so often on battlefields, and he absolutely saved her life. So there's that side of him, mm-hmm. which you couldn't have wanted a better, more practical, and braver friend. Mm-hmm. Now, the whole point about it, in order to understand something about Hemingway, you have to understand something about contradiction, because he was nothing except contradiction. He hated war, spoke against war, and he was very keen to get into war and report on war. Mm-hmm. He had complicated attitudes to women. Mm-hmm. Very complicated attitudes on racism, homophobia, very complicated, nasty attitudes to other writers. If they were rivals,
yes.
he was just nasty to them. If they were younger writers, he was helpful.
And he wanted to beat a lot of them up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he was, remember, he loved boxing. He loved getting in the ring and sparring. He also hated losing. He was a very dirty fighter.
Yeah, you said don't get in the ring with him because he'll cheat.
He cheated all the time. there was a Yankee pitcher once who got into the ring with him, who knocked him down, and Hemingway was so furious he kicked him in the balls. I mean, you see what I mean?
Yeah, I do see. Let me say, this is Hemingway Lives, Clancy Siegel, Why Reading Ernest Hemingway Matters Today, and it's orbooks.com. And by the way, you have a new name, of course. You're ClancySiegel.com, so Mr.com. People can go to ClancySiegel.com. You can also get the book. This character, I want to make sure we touch on this. He came to Toronto and worked for the Star, and I've been reading, thanks to you, I've been rereading his Star articles. He was on this danger of World War II. He was right on it. He said, the way Clemenceau, Poincaré are handling this, we're going to have another war.
And he was a terrific political correspondent. When he went to work for the Toronto newspaper, he went and interviewed, he saw what Hitler was doing, he went and interviewed Mussolini, and immediately saw through them, and immediately developed what I call an anti-fascism of the heart. Mm-hmm. Whatever else you say about Hemingway personally, he was a strong, fervent, consistent anti-fascist, and hated fascism, hated the bullying aspect of fascism, and when pinch came to shove, he got involved in the Spanish Civil War physically at the risk of his life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it helped a lot that his third wife, Martha Gellhorn, was even more passionately committed to left-wing politics than he was.
Yeah, and I may as well ask you, the fifth column, which is, I want to know what you think of it as a play. It's certainly an interesting thing. Some people claim that, of course, the woman in the play is Gellhorn, but how could that be? She was as tough as he was.
Well, she was the only woman in his life, probably aside from his mother, who ever stood up to him. Because it must have been really hard. He had his enormous reputation as a writer. He was a bully. He was physically strong. He was so active. He was sexy. Mm-hmm. And women found it very hard to stand up to him. But Gellhorn did, because Gellhorn was a writer on her own. Gellhorn had written like 20 books, not yet, but she wanted, and she'd written a huge amount of journalism. She felt herself, she respected him and his work, but she felt herself his equal. And that was a very hard thing for Hemingway to take once the Second World War especially broke out, and she said, bye-bye, honey, I'm off to do my job. And he sent her this telegram. Are you my wife? Are you in my bed? Or are you a reporter? And the answer was, I'm a reporter.
So he did she gave him a Hemingway answer.
Yeah, well, he did the dirty on her. You know, he took her job at Collier's as a war correspondent, and he went in her place, and he lands on D-Day, and she had to come a little bit later. And yeah. Then they teamed up in Europe. But she didn't give way. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously one of the reasons why they split up. Incidentally, that film, Hemingway and Gellhorn by Phil Kaufman, is not the worst film I've ever seen about Hemingway. The Woody Allen movie is terrible. This is not such a bad movie.
Yeah, we're going to list them as to moving back from, that's not the worst one. By the way, you and your wife wrote the screen, was it for television, wasn't it? Account of Hemingway and the nurse that he was first involved with that led to A Farewell to Arms.
Yeah, Janice Tidwell and I.
Now, when you and Tidwell were doing that, did you get the bug then that maybe you ought to take your research and turn it into a book?
No, not at all. Because getting involved in writing a movie, once that's done, the last thing in the world you want to do is go back and revisit. We were very lucky to meet the man who wrote the underlying book of the movie, who had actually been in the hospital with Hemingway. And that was a terrific experience, just to be able to talk to him.
Mm-hmm.
That was just another connection.
Oh, that's,
but
yeah.
You have to remember that I've been reading Hemingway since I was 15 years old, reading and rereading, and I read him first for the sex parts. And with some disappointment, I realized there wasn't a whole lot of explicit sex there. And then as I got
And you stole the book from the Chicago Library. Did you ever take that back?
No.
Okay, well, I'm turning you in. I can't. I'm sorry. I've already done it.
But they were terrific. But, you know, when you're a 14, 15-year-old kid and somebody tells you there's a lot of sex in a book, you go ahead and read it.
Yeah.
And I was stunned by what I was reading, because I've never read anything like that in my life. The words and the sentences were so very simple. Nothing I had read up to that point was as simple as that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, this can't be real writing, because real writing really is complicated writing. And if you go to any of his sentences, any of his first sentences, it's just amazingly, in the late summer of that year, we lived in a house in a village that looked across the river to the plain mountains. In the bed of the river, there were pebbles, etc.
Yeah.
It's so simple, you can actually see it. He wrote like a screenwriter. You can actually see it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a new experience for me, because I've been reading writers who wrote much more complicated ways, because
flowery.
That was a conventional right,
yeah.
way to write.
By the
that.
Way, you have a sentence here I want to read to people. His simplicity camouflages deep, hard-to-control passion. And that really gets it. I mean, he was boiling over, but he managed to hold himself in and write those sentences.
I think that's probably the key of all keys to Hemingway. He was part of the World War One generation, and World War One was a total humane human catastrophe, and it left everybody connected with it, people who'd fought in it, wounded by it, or on the sidelines, devastated. And the feelings you had about basically a useless war was so full of rage and mm-hmm. hatred and complicated emotions and pain mm-hmm. that only way that Hemingway found to deal with this was to express it very coolly and often not very directly. He said he wrote like he played pool. I think he called it a three-cushion shot.
Yeah, that's that's billiards, right? That's not snooker.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so he wanted to write these hot emotions in the coolest possible way. And my first impression of Hemingway was, this guy feels nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And that really stunned me. And at first, I probably didn't like Hemingway. As I grew older and began to read him again and again, I began to understand some of the feelings that were there, that if he hadn't found a way to control them, he would have killed somebody or killed himself.
Yeah. But by the way, yeah, with the boxing analogies, which he liked, I mean, he went for the knockout. He was always going for the knockout.
Exactly the way Teddy Roosevelt did.
This is, I better keep saying, this is Clancy Siegel. The book is Hemingway Lives, and by the way, it is a perfect introduction, and everybody who takes a course in literature ought to get themselves a copy. And it's Orr Books, and of course, there's also this new spot, ClancySiegel.com. Now, he came out of that war. He had a nasty wound. He anticipated that World War II might be coming because of the peace of World War One. But then in between comes the nasty 30s, and you write about the 30s and what he witnessed. And, you know, yesterday there was a big demonstration in Washington. You talked about the bonus march, and you said these guys were dangerous. The vets were dangerous because they could go left, they could go right. They dealt with them ferociously. Can you talk about how that led into further to his feelings?
The end of Herbert Hoover's administration, before Franklin Roosevelt came in, 50,000 veterans and their families, hungry, starving, tired, had crossed the country by foot, came to Washington and said, hey, look, you promised us a $500 war bonus when we enlisted. Can we have our money? And the Hoover administration said, no. And the veterans had nowhere to go, so they squatted in Washington, built shanty towns, and at that point, the word goes out, get rid of these potential subversives. And we're talking about women and children, too. And General MacArthur puts on his clean uniform. He's assisted by General Eisenhower, his aide-de-camp.
Every last one.
General Major Patton to take his cavalry and the tanks to attack the veterans, crush the shanty towns, and get them the hell out of Washington. We don't want to see these people. God knows what they are capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a huge battle, fortunately caught on newsreel, and the newsreels were shown all over America, and there was such booing and hissing all over the place, and it was the beginning of ordinary people's hatred for General MacArthur. Now, Hemingway, I think, was living in the States, and he certainly knew about it. Mm-hmm. Shortly afterwards, there was a Katrina-like storm that hit near Key West, where he was living. The new Roosevelt administration, fearing the potential of veterans, had sent hundreds of veterans down to the lowlands on allegedly job schemes, and when the without any and they knew the hurricane was coming without any preparation, a hurricane hit, hundreds of veterans were drowned, and mm-hmm. Hemingway was a witness to this and was enraged because the one loyalty he felt was to other war veterans, and he wrote this amazing editorial for a communist magazine at the time, Who Murdered the War Vets? And he put it squarely at the feet of the new president, Roosevelt, and his rich friends.
Yeah.
And I think that was the serious beginning of, I guess you'd call it, a social conscience mm-hmm. by Hemingway, who had been pretty apolitical up to then. One of the amazing things, a lot of his friends in Paris had gone fascist because it was very chic and very popular at the time to admire Mussolini, etc., but not Hemingway.
Mm-hmm.
Even Gertrude Stein was friendly toward the fascists, and Gertrude Stein was his sort of godmother of his first child and his literary mentor. But yeah. Hemingway...
Ezra Pound, yes.
Hemingway was built a different way. He saw, with his heart, he saw what fascism was really up to. And when the vets were so badly treated, this just blew his mind completely, and shortly afterwards... He wrote the only novel he ever said in the United States, To Have and Have Not. And we've all seen the movie, and the movie has nothing to do with the book. And Hemingway was perfectly happy.
That's a piece of luck.
the book, Take the Money and Run. it's a lovely movie. It has nothing to do with the book. I think it's a fine book. I think it's one of his best. Critics didn't like it at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, you made me reread it, and I agree with you, but it becomes particularly powerful in the last third of it. It just strikes me that, you know, I'm saying to myself, what's going on here, you know? And then it really turns into something where you have these wealthy guys, and they're strange. He tells you who they are and how well they're doing, and while everybody else is, he explains it. Why some have it and some don't, and the ugly consequences. I love that last line, of course. Alone, you can't accomplish a blasted thing.
At the time he wrote that book, Hemingway was consumed by class hatred. He really hated that whole class of people into which he himself, because mm-hmm. he was beginning to make money, would come, and also because he met his second wife, was very rich,
mm-hmm.
Something that he always felt very guilty about, but created two of his best stories, Snows mm-hmm. of Kilimanjaro and Francis McComber.
Mm-hmm.
He married up to get literary life going, but he also had a lot of guilt about it. Who of us who've divorced has not felt guilty about it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he did. And the way he expressed it was to give all of the royalties for The Sun Also Rises to his first wife, who he always said was the real love of his life, which totally pissed off his last wife, Mary.
But you have
to remember that. A lot of his posthumous work,
yeah.
A Movable Feast, etc.
Yeah. People can't resist tinkering with the poor devil's work, right? I mean, by the way, this is, again, I want to remind everybody, Clancy Siegel, Hemingway Lives, Why Reading Ernest Hemingway Matters Today. You really touch on an important point. You say he's got a great career in front of him, but we all have to worry that his works are being tampered with because the family is still around and they can't keep their hands off it.
Well, that's probably a delicate subject. Mary's gone, but when books came out, Patrick, the brother who I believe is still with us, and the editors saw fit to do it their way, and they had certain emotional and financial things to guard. You have to remember that after Hemingway died, Hemingway became a brand like Elvis.
Yes.
I mean, you have...
They sell shotguns using his name.
that amazed me. Who's got the chutzpah to come out with a shotgun,
yes.
the thing that yes. Hemingway shot himself with, and call it a Hemingway gun? But anyway.
Maybe it's a suggestion. I don't know.
Right. In Key West, of course, Key West plays up the Hemingway reputation tremendously. They always have Hemingway beard contests, et cetera, et cetera. In Ketchum, Idaho, where he spent his last days, they're much more discreet about it. He loved Idaho. The people of Ketchum sort of guard his privacy. So it's a lot easier to get down to Key West and grow a beard than it is to go to Ketchum and visit their house,
yeah.
which is not easy to do.
Yeah, you have to go out in the weather and do something if you're in Idaho.
Right. So the important thing is, the big problem with Hemingway, it turns out, is the image versus the writing, and the image overtakes the writing. And he colluded in this toward the end of his life,
mm-hmm.
Giving all sorts of interviews, playing the big-time writer. But the fact of the matter is, it's the work that counts, and the kick that I get is going back to read the stories, for example, the short stories,
mm-hmm.
Big Two-Hearted Country, etc. And the amazing changes it makes in me when I read them, because I make up my mind about a Hemingway story. 6 months later, I reread it, and I say, my God, I missed the whole thing that he was really talking about. So it gets new. And the mark of a genius writer is it keeps getting new each time you read it.
You introduced me. I had not ever thought about a story called Under the Ridge, but you said you were surprised that one got published anywhere. And that one, it's just like a punch in the chest. That is a heck of a story.
Which one is that?
Under the Ridge, about the poor guy, the guy with the angry Spaniard who says, why are all you people here? I hate all of you.
Right. And also he was not without insight. Some of his Spanish short stories are among the most immortal. He wrote a story once called The Denunciation, in which clearly Hemingway, it's very autobiographical, where Hemingway actually cooperates in the process of denouncing somebody, and says at the end of the story, writers are really not very nice people.
Yeah, so, the butterfly in the tank.
Yeah.
I got to ask you, that looked, and some people, the critics, some say that that's a they believe it's an attempt at a collaborative story, because actually the guy who runs the bar says to him, you better write about this. This is a good story. And you better title it The Butterfly in the Tank. And he says, I don't think that's a very good title. But then he does give it that title. That's a kind of a cute device going on there.
We all collaborate. I mean, you're probably giving me a story, an idea for a short story right now. I mean, no writer writes alone. You steal ideas, you pick up ideas, you read the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
And incidentally, he was an immense reader. I mean, remember, there was the macho chest-thumping guy, but he was a serious intellectual. He had bad eyes, bespectacled, read all the time, constantly read. His first wife, Hadley, said that when they were in bed together, he would snuggle up to her, and behind her back, he would be reading a newspaper. He never stopped reading, and he never stopped reading to his kids.
And
he had three sons.
Oh, that's great. The other thing I noticed about him, which is very un-American, he had all these languages. He was reading Spanish and French. I assume he read Italian. So he was sampling a much wider garden than most American authors.
If you choose to live in Paris and fall in love with Paris, just read A Movable Feast, you'll pick up French or you'll die. I lived in Paris. I found it very difficult to pick up French, and I almost died. Obviously, had a flair for the language.
Yeah. I want to remind everybody, and by the way, Clancy, you're being very patient with it. I hope you can go a little longer here. This is Hemingway Lives, Why Reading Ernest Hemingway Matters Today. It's Clancy Siegel, or books, and it's clancysiegel.com. You ought to get a copy of this. I want to make sure we touch on this thing that he was angry about the 30s. He was elated on the line with who murdered the vets. But then he saw maybe the answer to all of his anger in Spain. Did Spain, that was his hope, but did it break his heart, I guess, is the question I want to ask.
Well, Well, Spain was the great drama. It was felt at the time by good-hearted people that if we stop the fascists in Spain, that we could stop Hitler and Mussolini, and there won't be this big Second World War. And we lost. Franco and the fascists beat the loyalists, beat the Democrats. Hemingway reported on the war, took his life in his hands, put himself under quasi-communist discipline. He was never a communist, but he admired their sense of self-sacrifice and their willingness to die for a cause. At the same time, he was very clear-headed about the damage that the communists were doing to their own cause. There's a section in For Whom the Bell Tolls called The Gaylord Hotel, and anybody who ever thinks that Hemingway was, quote, soft on communism should have a look at it. It's very interesting that For Whom the Bell Tolls is a book much admired by John McCain, by Obama, by people of different political views.
Yeah, and a guy who knows something about guerrilla warfare, Fidel Castro.
You know, right. Now, Castro always boasted. Now, Castro and Hemingway would have gotten along wonderfully. They're both very macho. They both had mistresses. They both liked weapons. So, you know, they recognized the other person.
And, you know, there's a detail there that you point out about going way back to Hemingway got it right, and he was very precise in the information. And Fidel said in an interview, we learned from that. He talked about how to operate behind enemy lines as a guerrilla. And he says, you can study that. What a compliment.
Hemingway was a trained reporter. He knew how to use his eyes and ears. And I think probably they should be using parts of For Whom the Bell Tolls at military academies, because I'm sure that Hemingway absolutely got it right. Fidel said that, you know, he picked up lessons from the book. We don't know whether that's true or not, because both Hemingway and Fidel were great liars. Yeah. But they admired each other. Fidel regarded Hemingway as a, quote, a son of Cuba, and it is said that Hemingway gave money to the Fidelistas before the revolution. But once the revolution happened in Cuba, Hemingway and his wife got out of there and went back to America.
Yeah. Oh, now, I got to touch on that, too. And we got about 5-7 minutes, if you could stay with us on that day. This is a man who, because of his celebrity or his point of view, drew the attention of J. Edgar Hoover. And, by the way, you and I just laid out why J. Edgar Hoover might take an interest in him. We're talking about the FBI. But your account, I think, is that they came to Hemingway and said, you can't stay on here in Fidel's Cuba because that's going to look bad for your government. So he had to make up his mind to leave. But then also, they never left him alone, and it bothered him. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, J. Edgar Hoover detested Hemingway. It was probably a personal thing, too. Remember, Hemingway also had a homophobic streak, and that must have struck home with J. Edgar. But also, when Hemingway lived in Cuba, he made it his business to oppose and to root out fascists in Cuba. And that really pissed off the FBI, and Hemingway called the FBI agents a Jesuit morons. And so there was a gut hatred there right from the very beginning. And all it needed was for Hemingway to make a few speeches trying to collect money for ambulances for loyalist Spain. And right away, J. Edgar starts a file on him that went to 100 pages. And as everybody knows who's ever surveyed by the FBI, and I was, all it takes is once you appear in the card file index system they had then, they never let go. They stay on you.
Fill up the file. You yourself, by the way, you were blacklisted, and you've had them on your tail.
Oh, yeah. I took it as a perfectly natural part of living at the time.
A compliment of a great author.
Yeah, I mean, if you weren't surveyed by the FBI, you were nobody. But Hemingway, toward the end of his life, did become paranoid, and he would go to restaurants and look around and say, you see those two guys, those are FBI agents. And his friend said, hey, come on, you know, enjoy your dinner, You're getting paranoid. You're getting depressed. The fact of the matter is they might have been an FBI agent, because something we do know, when he was sent to or admitted himself to the Mayo Clinic right at the very end, at least one of his doctors was informing on him to the FBI, and his phone was tapped. So there was, paranoid have real enemies. And the one thing we know about J. Edgar is he was tenacious. He never let go.
Also, he wanted you to know he was there, right? I mean, in other words, he wanted you to become a little paranoid. He's looking in your window.
And his hatred for somebody as pure in heart, so anti-fascist as Hemingway, really was so logical for somebody like J. Edgar. And the sad part was that in the end, in a sense, J. Edgar won, because Hemingway ended up totally depressed, very paranoid. In the end, he did shoot himself when he found he couldn't write anymore. But when he killed himself, we lost something completely irreplaceable.
Yeah. Well, I guess I better say last point here. I want to make sure you say that we may have a new Hemingway in the sense that there are still things that we don't. Not all of his letters are published. There are still manuscripts, and you suggest that his son, who was most like him physically and as a writer, probably worked on his mind a little bit. You think he was some of his views shifted with the time as they had previous?
Listen, Hemingway walks in on his third wife's bedroom. They find his 10-year-old son trying on his wife's dress and stockings. Just imagine what this did to Hemingway's masculine macho mind. He never, ever got over it. Gig, the son, Gregory, did get over it. Gregory had no problems about living a double life as a man and as a transgender or cross-dresser or whatever you want to call it. He went to medical school, became a respected doctor, fathered gazillions of children, but also was picked up by the cops in dresses and things like that. Hemingway just was enraged by his son and never could handle that. And you might have traces of that in some of his later work, like The Garden of Eden, where sex is sort of turned on its head. If Hemingway had lived and had a bit of a peaceful life, we might have had a completely new and different Hemingway. Let me add just one thing. This is a very short book, and I'm very anxious to see it in the hands of younger people, whether it's in the classroom or out of the classroom. It's an easy read.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We're going to do all our... We're going to be reading from it, if we have your permission. We'll make sure that we read passages. It is a terrific book. And Clancy Siegel, you've already, of course, everybody knows, made a great contribution to literature yourself and served in World War II. I mean, you were in the Army and got there, probably under the influence of Ernest Hemingway.
No question. When I went into the Army, I wanted to be a Hemingway hero, and the Army put me straight on that right away.
Yeah, we're glad you didn't get blown away for the effort. Well, Clancy, thank you very, very much. It's always a great pleasure to talk to you.
It's a great pleasure to be here, and hello to your listeners, and have a look at Hemingway again, even if you think you've read him, or worse, if you were assigned him in school, which is the worst possible fate.
I thought I knew about him until I read your book, and I realized, hey, I better go and start all over again. So thank you very, very much.
My pleasure. Take care.
Clancy Siegel, thank you. Bye-bye. And that is Clancy Siegel, the book, I'm going to tell you again, Hemingway Lives, Why Reading Ernest Hemingway Matters Today. By the way, his short stories, he also argues in the book that he's basically a short story writer who wrote some novels, but his forte is a short story. We just had a Nobel Prize winner, Alice Munro, here, with everybody that's talking about it. And thank goodness, the debate about, well, do you have to have a novel? No. If you wrote The Snows of Kilimanjaro, that's good enough. You did it. Now, I'll tell you again, you're listening to The Taylor Report. It's CIUT 89.5 FM. And make sure you're with us for the membership drive on the 21st. We're going to be asking. So you're going to, I assume, say you support CIUT, you support The Taylor Report, and you will become a member. We're going to be talking in a moment with David Jacobs about the Chartists.